Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Anahuacis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation. Well, our guest this evening is Carol Shoemaker of the Cherokees. And say hi, Carol, OCO.
OCO, Bluewater, and Dohichu. How are you?
Dohiji, Osta. I'm fine.
That's good. That's good. I'm just learning Cherokee, too.
Me, too.
but too. I am honored to be on the show.
Well, we're, you're one of these multicultural people like me, and I was looking at your website, there's a link to it available on the show page, and I encourage everybody to go over there. And but you've got a fascinating background, and geez, looks like you're a veteran, go ahead and tell us about yourself. I'm dying to hear.
Well, I hope what I have to say will help some people. I know that you are about prophecy. And so what I would like to do is paint a picture, and how I paint that picture is if you walk with me on the journey that I took. And I was adopted about when I was 2.5 years old, and did not learn anything about my ethnic background until my early 20s. I was raised in in Maryland. Spent most of Maryland, D.C. area, and I joined the military when I was 18, and my first duty station was at was in Fort Myer, Virginia, and I worked in the Pentagon there in military intelligence. And
what years was that?
I'm sorry.
What years was that?
Oh, okay. I entered the Army in 1965, and you know there were lots of things going on at that time. We had the civil rights movement.
Oh, yeah, I'll say.
Yeah, in fact, I'll tell you what happened to me when I was stationed in Fort McClellan, Alabama. And you might remember that there were three people that were, there were civil rights workers that had been murdered there in Alabama. And you know, we would get a pass to go in town, and really town was Anniston. It was like one street that was town. And so four of us went in to go to lunch. You know, we had to wear our uniforms. And four of us girls went in to lunch, and we sat down. And you know, nobody came over to ask us what we wanted to eat. And so, you know, when people come in and they waited on them and everything, and so finally we said, you know, you haven't come over to us, you haven't taken our order, what's the problem? And the girl said, she pointed to a notice on the wall, and it said, no colored served. And there was, what she said was, I can serve you, you, and you, pointing to three of us, and one of us was a black girl. She was actually from the South. So we got up and left. We walked outside, and there was the Ku Klux Klan outside. They were across the street, and they did not have their masks on, actually. They had their, you know, their dress or their gowns on, but didn't have the, they actually showed their faces. I guess they didn't feel that there was a problem there. So we sat down. We were there for about an hour. It was probably the longest hour one of the longest hours of my life. And but I think one of the reasons they didn't do anything was because they didn't want the military coming down on them there. And another, of course, I always point to the Creator watching over us, you know.
Well, they messed with you. They're breaking federal law because you were. You were classed as a federal person. There's a different ball of wax than if it was a person who's a state citizen, and the feds would have been involved. Long story short.
Right, and the three that were, you know, that were killed there were private citizens. Actually, they were from New York, I think, I believe. But I went to. My first duty station, like I said, was at the Pentagon, and which was very interesting. And then I went to Chicago Fifth Army. I met my ex-husband in Washington. We got married, and so I was living in Chicago. In Chicago, there's a lot of ethnic groups, and this is the first time that I'd ever come across the ethnic groups. And this is where I was asked what nationality I was, what country I was from. I'd never come across that before. And then the questions got more specific. And I had gotten a job for the federal government, and the man who was interviewing me said, look, you know, it has nothing to do with the job, but are you Jewish? And I was like, Jewish? I didn't even know what Jewish was. And I said, no, I'm German and Irish. That was what my adoptive parents were.
Mm-hmm.
So he just kind of looked at me strange. And there was this little old lady who was had called the receptionist. We had the desks that were facing the supervisor. And she called the supervisor. A supervisor puts her phone down, and she looks at me, and she says, Carol, are you Jewish? I was like, what in the world? And so what I did is I called my birth mother because I knew everybody by that time. And I said, are we Jewish? And she said, well, Dad said we're German Jews. And, you know, when she said that, it was like, it clicked. It was like, okay. You know, and nobody ever asked me again. That was it. They didn't ask me. So it was, for me, it was like a confirmation. I didn't really investigate anything about the Jewish, you know, the Jewish part or anything until probably 1987. Well, 1983 is when I'd heard this guy, you probably heard of him, Sid Roth, and I'd heard him on the television.
Mm-hmm.
And he has that show Supernatural or something. Well, anyway, I met him in Rockville, Maryland. He was in Rockville at the time. And he was on TV, and he said, oh, you know, you can believe in Jesus and still be a Jew. And I was like, what? So I went to meet him, and a very nice man. And that next year, my grandmother, my birth grandmother, gave me her Bible. And the following year, she passed on. Well, in 1987, I was in California. And, I'm sorry, before I got to California, it was a particularly distressing time. And, I heard this voice. It was, remember the Sabbath day. And I was like, well, I go to church on Sundays, you know. So I got my grandmother's Bible, and I opened it up. I started reading it. I had had it since, that was about 4 years now, or 3 years now. And so I started reading. It was at that time I began to have dreams and visions. And it was at that time that I started to wonder about what was my purpose. Now, you see, my grandmother was a medicine person. Okay, for the town that we lived in, or the town that she lived in. And when anyone was sick, they called my grandmother. And so, and she would go to West Virginia, Maryland, Virginia, D.C., and she would go around in those areas. And so anyway, I started to have these dreams and visions, and I went to California. Somebody invited me to, it was a Messianic congregation. You've probably heard of the Messianic
movement.
So I went there.
We got one here in town.
I'm sorry?
We have a Messianic congregation here in town.
Oh, okay. I went there. Someone invited me. I went over there, and, you know, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was like coming home. I heard this Hebrew music, and you know, it was just, so it was a connection for me. For the next 7 years, I wanted to go to Israel. I mean, I was like, I have to go to Israel. I prayed to go to Israel. Well, 7 years later, I did go to Israel. And this was 1994. And you may have remembered, July of 1994, there was a comet that hit Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
It was called
Shoemaker-Levy.
The Shoemaker-Levy comet. Well, my last name is Shoemaker. And but I'd never heard of it. I'd never heard of that comet. One of the astronomers was Carolyn Jean Shoemaker, which is my name. So when I got to, or the day before I arrived in Tel Aviv, there was the man who wrote the Bible code. And he had gotten there. He arrived there. He was going to, he went to tell Yitzhak Rabin about what he had seen in the Bible code, the assassination attempt or something. So he had gotten there, and then I arrived in Tel Aviv the next day with my two children. The following day we went to apply for citizenship, for Israeli citizenship. Now, mind you, I couldn't prove anything. But It didn't dawn on me. When I arrived at the airport, they said, "Do you want to become an Israeli citizen?" I said, "Yes." They stamped my passport. I go to the interior of the interior department, and I'm waiting for my number to be called, which is really, really kind of interesting because someone put a bomb next to me. So when I say I was waiting for my number to be called, it was kind of, that's what almost happened there. I probably, someone said, they told me, for asking to the restroom, can I leave this here? I'm sure, I did not know that you were not supposed to do this. So there was some police that came in. I would kind of look over, but at the bag, but the place was packed, so they came over to me and they asked me if it was mine. I said no. They said, okay, could you please go over to? They moved everybody to one side. Took the bag outside of it. It was like a veranda outside the building, and defused it. Now, I just thought it was kind of the lay of the land later. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of thing just happened. But this would happen 3 more times. and I was in Israel a total of 5 months. So anyway, I was went to a place. I lived on a moshav. A moshav is where you have...
I know exactly what a moshav is, yeah.
Yes? Okay.
Yeah, it's... Well, you tell me if I'm wrong. As I was explaining to Chief Joe, you've got kibbutzim, which are they're all things common, but the kibbutz owns everything. But a moshav is modified, where people can own their own stuff. And if I was going to establish something like that in the United States, that's the way I would go, because it. It's a little bit more natural, but anyway, yeah. So I'm with you.
That's right. That's exactly what it is. They had people there who they were called caravans that they lived in. They're uh-huh. actually mobile homes,
uh-huh.
No frills mobile homes on a concrete slab, and those people live there who are waiting for their citizenship, and then you have the permanent residents.
Uh-huh.
And so I was, when we got there, you probably heard of this person also. He was an archaeologist. He passed on. Vendel Jones.
Vendel, uh-huh.
Right. His son Gershom came over and asked me if, invited me to stay in his father's caravan until I had gotten my citizenship. His father was at a dig in, I believe it was in Jericho or Salt Sea. I think that's where he was. I had never heard of him.
I'll bet that's the same dig where my friend Magid Ben Yosef was. His American name is Del Griffin, and he was covering the dig for Jerusalem Post. And he went up on a mesa overlooking where Vendel was doing core sampling. And he looked down and saw what looked like an eagle's nest, and slid down there, and he felt cold air coming out of a hole. And long story made short, Vendel excavated that. And that was the cave that had fallen in many times. They removed hundreds of tons of stuff, but they found the temple incense in there. And Vendel also found a lot of other... stuff related to the temple, and didn't he find the copper scroll?
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Folks, the scriptures say, "My people perish for lack of knowledge." We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Before he passed away in 1985, Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files in 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all 145 past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. We had a very close call at the end of last month. We almost didn't raise the funds that we needed to stay here on Blog Talk Radio. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look, Nation.
I can't remember whether you did or not, but it's interesting that you say that because now I know Magid Ben Yosef too, and I but you know, when I was staying there in Vendel Jones's caravan, I heard this voice. It said the voice said. Vendel Jones has found the ashes of the red heifer.
Mm.
Okay, that's what I heard. And it was like, what does this mean? You have to remember that I really didn't know anything about it. I wasn't involved.
You're new at all. Uh-huh, gotcha.
Yeah. So, but this is what I heard. And anyway, I got my citizenship in 10 days, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
Okay. And there were some people that they couldn't believe. They said, "But we've been waiting for a year here." They were from Mexico, and they've been waiting for a year, and here I get my citizenship in 10 days. I will tell you also that somebody asked me to take a blood test. And they asked me and my daughter. They did not ask my son. But here's what they told me. They said, there's some kind of, I don't know what it was, virus or something was going on, okay? And we needed to take, they needed to take a blood test. But they didn't take everybody's blood.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, they took our blood, you know. I personally believe, this is my belief, okay, that, you know, you've heard of the Cave of Machpelah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where the patriarchs and matriarchs are buried, not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And but I believe that they took the DNA from that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and they know who everybody is. I mean, you know, they can tell who everybody is.
Sure.
So that is that's what happened, and it was after that I got my my citizenship. So. Then later, I was asked by this man who, he was a Republican. He said, he was there on the Mojave. Would you like to meet Hillary Clinton? And I'm like, well, sure, why not? And so he asked me to deliver a message for the children of Kfar Adamim. And she was going to be in Jerusalem because Bill Clinton was in, at that time he was in Jordan. They were having the peace conference in Jordan. And so I you know, went to Jerusalem, and she was in a hotel, and they had, it was kind of like, you know, where they rope off an area. There was probably about 300 people. But I was going to make sure that I was going to be right there, because I went to deliver a message. And I got a little ahead of myself, but I'll come back to what I want to say. Anyway, this is, and so, you know, she comes, it was Hillary Clinton and I believe Yitzhak Rabin's wife and the president's wife, the president of Israel's wife there. And so she comes around and you know, shakes everybody's hand and everything. And so I hand her the message. And the message was, do not send troops to the Golan Heights. Now, little did I know that 15 years later she would be the Secretary of State. But what I wanted to say also, that I was a messenger at that time. Okay, I did
right.
not know that I. There was a reason for that. In 1987, I told you at the Messianic Congregation, and I just completely overlooked this part. I had been given a message for the people. Now I thought that the people meant Jews. That's what I thought. Okay. And then in 1987, it was tell the people the time is short. Everybody loved that message. I mean, I could just tell somebody and they would say, oh, yes, you know, the time is short. In 1992, I was given a second part of the message. Tell the people the time is short and to prepare to leave this country. So that message was not well received. Okay, people did not want to hear that message. And after that, in 1992, when I received the second part, you remember that was the 500-year marker of the Inquisition.
Uh-huh.
It was during Passover, and in the newspaper, there was, in the food section, no less, there was an apology by King Juan Carlos of Spain. He was apologizing to the Jews for the Inquisition and invited them back to their homeland. Well, he couldn't have been inviting them to Spain because Spain was never their homeland. So anyway, that all led up to going to Israel. Now, I had told you about the comet.
Uh-huh.
And what I didn't realize until I came back was the meaning of the comet. I had spoken to some rabbis, and I had asked them what was the meaning of the comet. And they said it means the Messiah is on the way. So what I thought about it, after I meditated about it, and this took years, by the way, I looked at it like I was kind of a neon sign because my name was the name of one of the astronomers.
Yeah.
And it was saying that the Messiah is on the way. Now, of course, it's not a message to everybody because everybody's not aware of that. But for those people in the know, that is what they saw. And you know what? I believe my reward. You remember I'd prayed to go to Israel for 7 years. And my reward was to become a citizen. That is what I wanted so much. But I thought I was going to be in Israel forever. Not so. I had to return. And the message for the people I would come to learn was for the Indian people.
Uh-huh.
I would come to find out that they were all called the people.
Uh-huh.
In general, that's for the American Indians, but in specific, the Cherokee. Now, when you were playing the intro to the program,
uh-huh.
Thunderheart. Well, what was interesting is in 1996, somebody told me, you need to watch Thunderheart. And I watched it, and I tell you, I've seen that movie probably 30 times.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Where I know it frame by frame, you know. And in about 2 years ago, in 2000, probably 2004, I took a DNA test. And here they, you know, they have it, it's, they do it in Houston. And this lady last year contacted me, and she said, you know, we're cousins. And she had a list of names, you know. And I look in their Indian names. I mean, it's like Iron Eyes and stuff like that. I'm like, what? So I asked her, I said, are you American Indian? And she says, yes, I'm a Dakota. She's from the, not Lakota, but Dakota.
Uh-huh.
And she is from Standing Rock.
Uh-huh.
Okay, she's an enrolled member of Standing Rock. But she told me that her great-grandfather was from Pine Ridge. Well, that's where Thunderheart's from, right?
Uh-huh.
That's where the story is about. And his name is Brown Thunder. And I'm going, Thunderheart, Brown Thunder. Oh, like,
uh-huh.
This is just too crazy, you know? And then I found out that this is just in the last couple of years, my family name, which is my birth name, which is Spong or Spang, the chief of the Northern Cheyenne his birth name.
Huh.
In fact, there's a large family among the Northern Cheyenne who are Spangs. So while I have not made I do know that the Northern Cheyenne and the Lakota are cousins.
Well, there's been a close affinity. Well, let's put it this way. Grandfather Richard Craker, he's one of the last Ottawahees. He met, well, back in the 60s, when he met Grandfather Oscar, who taught him to be a Cherokee Ottawahee. Most Cherokees were not interested in our own culture, but they were interested in Cheyenne stuff. And there's Cheyenne people are very friendly, very gregarious, and there's a real affinity there with the Cherokees I'm talking about. They're good folks.
Oh, yeah. And you know that their name, they're called Tsitsistas.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know what the Tsitsis are?
Yeah, bird class.
No, the Tsitsis. The Tsitsis.
Oh, Tsitsis. Oh, okay.
The fringes
on the fringes.
That were
right.
In Deuteronomy, where they're told to make the fringes.
Uh-huh.
So I thought that was very interesting that is their name. That's what they go by.
Well, and ribbon shirts, you know, a lot of them have not only the two ribbons in the front, but in the back also.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know a lot about the Cheyenne, but in 1996, this was after Thunderheart portion, when told me they could find out about my adoption.
Uh-huh.
And this person was working for the Sac and Fox in Oklahoma, and he told me that I was Cherokee from the Bird Clan, but I would have to prove it. So I was like, oh, brother. But the thing is that I know that, the Bird Clan are messengers. I was a messenger. I have been a messenger since 1987. My mother was a messenger. On my birth certificate, it says, what is her occupation? It's messenger.
By the way, what is your birth date? And keep talking, and I'm going to run your Torah portion. Go ahead.
Oh, my birth date is the year or the whole date?
The whole
June 12th, 1946.
6/12/46. Born before or after sundown?
I was born after.
Okay.
No, wait. 1:23 a.m.
Okay. And, keep talking, and we'll find out. Just keep talking, and I'm working. we'll get to the bottom. You glad?
My mother was a messenger for the British government. And I had never, ever heard anybody say anything about that before. So, but I see that she was a messenger. So I understand it to be from the Bird Clan. That does connect, you know. And the Cherokee connect for me, I see them really as being a part of Levi and Judah. And, you know, because they have the fire, which is the, in the temple, and they have the cities of refuge. And
well, in Second Maccabees, the keepers of the fire left the land, and Magid Ben Yosef found that that little bit of information. So, yeah, there's yeah, just keep talking.
So I saw that. Now, on my father's side, which is interesting, too, my father's last name is Coffin.
Really?
And, yeah, and the coffin is the Aron. You know where you carry the Torah?
Uh-huh.
It's the box. People, the coffin where dead people go, right? Well, the only ones that
ark,
can...
Yeah.
Are the ark, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, ark is what it meant. And,
same thing, yeah.
Yeah, well, the coffin, or also it could have been Cohen. It could have come from Cohen,
uh-huh.
But coffin is ark. And my father's from North Carolina, but actually both of them had from North Carolina and then later in West Virginia. My grandfather's name is Emmet.
Uh-huh, which means truth.
This means truth, and then there was. I don't know if you've ever heard of Levi Coffin.
Uh-huh.
Levi Coffin helped with the Underground Railroad.
Uh-huh.
Helped the slaves get out of North Carolina. So, and then you have the Shoemaker Levy Comet.
Uh-huh.
Oh, see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second, per molecule, and this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim supercharges your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Well, you know, I believe that God was showing me that I'm from the tribe of Levi.
Well, guess what? Have you ever had anybody run your Torah portion?
No.
Okay. Well, you guessed right. Your Torah portion is, number one, a Torah portion is associated with your Hebrew birthday.
Uh-huh.
And, basically, it's a snapshot of your purpose or mission in life. Now, I had all kinds of clues that I was a Benjamite. And when I first started doing these interviews back in 2004, I interviewed Rabbi Mikhail Baron, who was one of the spokesmen for the revived Sanhedrin. And we got to talking a lot because we just got to be real good friends. And he asked me, he says, "Who is your father?" And I said, "Well," I said, "you know, my dad was born in Minneapolis, but his dad was born in Sweden." And he says, "Oh," he says, "that explains some things." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, Blue Otter," he says, "did you know that," now, he said, "you'll find part of the story in your Bible," he says, "but there was a war between the Benjamites and the other 11 tribes. And in the first battle, they prevailed, but the second battle, so the story goes, they were all wiped out except for a few. And they later became, moved down to the southern kingdom, became temple guards, and, you know, the first two kings of Israel were Benjamites." But he says, "what really happened was, is they jumped, the vast majority of them left the land, and they jumped on ships with the Phoenicians, and they went to Scotland and Scandinavia and other places." And I said, "funny you should say that," I said, "because back in 1977, I had a dream of the back of my father's head, and I heard a voice say, 'Behold, a mighty Benjamite.'" And he says, "well," he says, "even if you're in the diaspora, even if your family have become Gentiles because they're out of covenant," he says, "you still have the lineage, you know, to your father." And I said, "well," I said, "my family, father's father's family lived near Lidköping, which was the ancient Viking capital, like forever, and we trace the genealogy back because they lived on the same piece of land all the way back to 1300 and before." He says, "well, it makes sense, but your Torah portion is, if I can pronounce this correctly, Parashat Bahalacha, and the first it is Numbers 8 verse 1 through Numbers 12 verse 16, and usually the first couple of words of the first line is very important, and the first line is God spoke to Moses, telling him,
"Oh God,"
and speak to Aaron, and this is specifically having to do with Levites. "Speak to Aaron, telling him, 'When you light the lamps, the seven lamps will illuminate the menorah.' Aaron did that, lighting the lamps to illuminate the menorah as God commanded Moses." And it goes on to, see, my wife's a Levite also, but this is, he goes on to say, "You shall stand the Levites before Aaron and his sons and designate them as a wave offering to God. In this manner will you separate the Levites from other Israelites, and the Levites shall become mine."
Well,
so that's who you are. And maybe a little later we can get Mark Borchardt online. And as a matter of fact, I'm not paying attention. Yeah, Mark, a little later on, give us a call, and maybe you can tell her about her Mayan birth sign. But okay, go ahead. I'm sure you're probably a little rattled right now. I was too. But go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, like with Ezra, you remember when Ezra went back and he finds the genealogy?
Uh-huh.
Books of genealogy, because there were people who wanted to be in the temple and they could not be.
Uh-huh.
Was he a Levite? Was Ezra a Levite?
I believe so. I'm not sure. I'll keep talking and I'll
Okay. Let's see. I'm trying to think of where I am now because I had lost you. Well, anyway, I was talking about my mother's a messenger and that kind of thing. And, and then I really started going into the Indian community, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This is because that's where I had to go. I hear that they're the people, and I go, oh, okay. And so the Cherokee, of course, I know that, you know, that just resonates with me, with the Cherokee.
Ezra was a scribe, apparently.
I'm sorry?
Ezra was a scribe.
Oh, he was a scribe. Okay.
Founder of the great assembly, most probably.
Most probably he was.
Because they're the ones that kept all the records.
Yeah. And, well, I'm into record keeping, too, I guess. Mm-hmm. I like, well, I'll get back to that. But, anyway, so, let's see, where was I? That's what happens when you get old, Blue Runner.
Oh, I know what you mean. while you're thinking about that, let me fill in a blank for you. I spent 15 months more or less homeless, and during that period of time, which would have been late 2009, early 2010, I visited Shreveport. And, as a matter of fact, I just posted this interview to the Facebook page of Rabbi Foster Calder. He is an ex-Air Force officer. He knew my teacher, John Red Hat Duke, who was also an Air Force officer. And but after he retired from the Air Force, he became a rabbi. He's an Orthodox and leader of a conservative congregation in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I spent a few weeks there, and he had me speak to his congregation because we had been talking about the similarities between the Cherokee language and the Hebrew language. And when we got done, he said, man, he says, you know, this is astounding. He says, you really ought to take this act on the road. He says, you know, Jewish congregations are looking for speakers all the time. But when I told him what John Red Hat told me, and John was a rabbi before he was in the Air Force. He was reformed, but he was born a traditional Cherokee from the Ketua lineage and converted to Judaism in the early 40s after having dreams concerning the Holocaust. He actually learned to speak German in his dreams. But what John figured out was, you know, one of the names for our people is Aniwiya, but Anikituwa is another name. But his grandmother, she was raised by two full-blood Cherokee grandmothers and a freed woman. And they pronounced Kituwa Kitu-ra. And he explained that in the old Cherokee, now lost dialect, the eastern or southern dialect, there was an R sound. And he says, you remember who Kitu-ra was?
Oh, yeah,
I said, yeah, the third wife of Abraham.
And, Abraham.
And he sent them away, blessing them that they would excel in herbalism and shamanism. But I explained a lot of other coincidences. Well, you know, Ani means the people in Cherokee, and it's Ami in Hebrew. And, of course, there's the 23 arguments that James Adair wrote in his book,
just
American Indians in middle 1700s. So, it's a subject close to my heart.
Oh yeah, and you probably, well, I know that you know about the Cherokee Nation of Mexico with Chief Jedlody Rogers.
Huh?
He's the chief now. Now it's called the Cherokee Nation of Sequoia.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was Sequoia's, Sequoia's the one that wanted all of the Cherokee to go to Mexico.
Uh-huh.
Cherokee,
they wanted to go to Mexico. They'd actually purchased a colony after the removal to what's now Oklahoma, and the War Department wouldn't let them go. That's
right.
We migrated back and forth between here and there.
And I think that it's very interesting that he, you know, about Mexico, about Texas. I've always felt that there's something in Texas that's a safe place.
Uh-huh.
Why? But that's because I never thought I would end up in Texas, but here I am, and I believe there's a safety here, you know. In learning that I was Indian, that I was Cherokee, and I got involved in intertribal activities first
uh-huh.
in West Virginia, and then when I came to Texas, you know. Because they really didn't have, that I knew about, the Cherokee, I don't want to say tribes because they're not, but bands or
clans.
Like,
right.
Clans or what, you know. And there wasn't anybody. Now, the Texas Cherokees were here. I just didn't know about them. Okay. And also, my son had died in 2002, so I wasn't really aware of a lot of things. But I did learn when I got on the computer, I learned there were two groups of people who were trying to find out where they belonged. There was there were people that believed they were Indian, and also they believed they were Jewish. So they were trying to find connections to the Jewish community and to the Indian community. Now, the Jews and the Indians are very much alike.
Uh-huh.
You know, I noticed, for instance, they're the only two people that have to prove who they are.
Yep.
You know, they have to have cards and show, you know, the Jews don't have to show what their blood quantum is or anything. But they, you know, they have to prove, they say, well, who is your mother? You know, it's all, who is your mother? And really, it's actually the father, when you get right down to it in the biblical part, who is a tribal affiliation.
Right.
So they'll ask, who is your mother, right? Now, with the Indians, the Cherokee, it's you belong to your mother's clan.
Mm-hmm.
West of the Mississippi, it's your father that they're interested in.
Yeah, the way Grandfather Richard explained it to me, he said, if you've ever been to a stomp dance, you know, the clans are arranged around the fire, and you're not allowed to, traditionally, he said, you're not allowed to marry into your clan or either the clan of your mother or father. And he says you have to cross the fire to find, the way the clans are seated around the fire is a little complicated, but yeah, there's rules, and basically it's because apparently, you know, Cherokees figured out that you've got to keep the gene pool varied, or you're going to have problems. And, yeah, it's very, very symbiotic. I mean, all anyone has to do is go to a stomp dance once, and they go, "Oh, the light goes on." They go, "Oh my gosh," you know. And
I've never been to a stomp dance.
Oh, you ought to sometime.
Yeah, I've never been to one. And I've never been to where they have one. That's probably why I haven't been to one.
It's a Cherokee version of church.
Oh. Oh, okay. I remember we used to call the stomp grounds where I lived. They would say, "Oh, these are the old stomp grounds," and I didn't know what they were talking about.
So, what area of the country was that?
I lived in Cabin. Well, I was born in Cabin John, Maryland, which is next to the Potomac River.
Mm-hmm.
It's right across from Virginia. I mean, Virginia and Maryland there. When the water is real low in the river, you can just walk across to Virginia, actually. There are a lot of Cherokee in West Virginia. Well, Virginia, West Virginia,
yep.
They went to the mountains.
All the way up the Appalachian chain. And Pocahontas' mother's name was Amoputuski. She was a Ketua clan woman, and she married Wahoon Sunukok, otherwise known as Powhatan, and Matoaka, who we know as Pocahontas, was one of the daughters. And so she was a half Cherokee, but she would have been Ketua clan. And that information you can find in the a museum in Tulsa.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals, and you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken tasting garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Maria.
Put it
Osmond.
Under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Maria Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
You see, my grandfather, I'm talking about the Spangs now, they are strong. We're in West Virginia. They had a, well, my great-grandfather was a lock keeper.
Hmm.
And so he would lift the locks for the boats to pass through.
Hmm.
So that was in Cabin John. But when he was in, but their home was in West Virginia in Shepherdstown. And Shepherdstown, you know, the canal comes 10. All the way down goes to Georgetown. So they had the boats. In fact, so they were boat people. I mean,
uh-huh.
They were, you know, they fishermen, stuff like that, because they lived on the water. They lived on the river and the canal.
Uh-huh.
So, but that's where they were from, West Virginia. And they had been in North Carolina as well, but like I said, that's why they went to West Virginia, because of the problems. I remember that my adoptive mother's family were Tuscarora.
Mm.
And I remember one of my aunts saying that, because they had come from North Carolina, and she said, this was like in the 30s, I think, the 1930s. She says, I remember when we were on the side, when the white people walked on the sidewalks and we had to get off. And I was like, it was the white people. I thought we were white. So they called themselves Black Dutch, Black Irish and Black Dutch. My grandmother told me, she says, your grandfather's Black Irish and I'm Black Dutch. And I was like, what is that? And then she said, only one clue I had was above her bed, she had a picture, she had a photograph of an Indian woman, a young Indian woman who was spearfishing. She had a canoe and she was spearfishing. And I know that picture was dear to her, otherwise she wouldn't have it there. And then she showed me her father's otterback. Her father had a Confederate soldier.
Uh-huh. Mine too.
She showed me his saber and his uniform. She had it in her cedar chest.
Oh, you're kidding.
My grandma was somewhere like 1988.
Wow.
So that's
the
only...
Did she happen to know what command he fought in?
You know, she didn't say, and I was young, and I didn't ask all the questions I should have
asked. Wow, you ought to find out who inherited that, and because I've got a friend that has similar artifacts, and he inherited, come to find out, his Cherokee ancestor was a Texas Cherokee, Southern Cherokee, and he fought under Stan Waite's command. And those people have a special set-aside agreement with the federal government, and they've been... Anyway, there's several groups of the Southern Cherokees. I was involved with one for a while. But, yeah, it'd be interesting if you could find out who inherited that stuff, because there might be letters that went back and forth between him and the home, and who knows.
That's true. That's true. I know that they lived in Virginia. My grandfather was, when they were in Washington, D.C., his father was a slave on a plantation in Virginia. My grandfather was a, took care of the horses and everything in the stables. They owned stables, his father and his brother. And he did that in Washington, D.C. My grandfather was born in 1878. So there's a lot of history there, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing once you crack the, make a little entry. You just got to keep looking.
That's true. So that's what the other thing that I wanted to talk about was I believe what I'm supposed to be doing. This is, I look at Moses when he went to Egypt, and he had to get all the tribes together. I believe that he had to get they had to get organized. They were slaves.
Uh-huh.
They were very disoriented there. And he had to get them together to move out. And I have felt this need to, like I said, I saw these people, they're looking for where they belong. They're trying to find their way home. And to help them to get there, they believe that they're Jewish and Indian. That is who they, I've got a lot of letters from when I was the ambassador to Israel for the Central Band of Cherokee. A lot of letters from these people that's who they believe they are. They're part
uh-huh.
of the Israel.
Well, you're not alone because, the Cherokee Nation of the old Louisiana Territory, their chief, wrote a book on the subject, and I know one of their clan chiefs I met in Missouri, and his family told him that when Egyptian artifacts started coming out of the ground in Illinois, that they were supposed to stand up and declare that they were, the Cherokees were related to the House of Israel. And Chief Beverly Baker wrote that book, We Have Not Been Conquered. And, and then there's a lot of Cherokees that think that it's complete hoorah.
Uh-huh.
But,
well,
you have to
make up your own mind, and when you think about it, not all of the Israelites or the Hebrews wanted to leave Egypt.
And a lot of them left, but they didn't follow Moses. They became the Spartans, and the tribe of Dan, a lot of them took off and went to a lot of places, and, they dispersed.
they just didn't want to belong. So I think that's sort of what the same thing. That's sort of what it's like, They just don't want to be a part of it. And if they don't want to, that's okay. That's their choice. But there are people who do want to be a part of the House of Israel. And, this is where, look at the, like the blood quantum thing.
Uh-huh. Okay?
They're keeping people out because they don't have the right amount of blood.
Uh-huh.
Makes no sense. It's from a foreign government. That's devilish. But any mother in their right mind is not going to allow something like that.
No.
Because they're not going to say, I don't want my grandchildren to come in. I don't want my great-grand. That's crazy. So this is why I like the Cherokee, how the women were, the clan mothers, that they had, how should I say this?
Well, they decided when you're going to go to war, and they had things. They determined who the chiefs were going to be, and they deposed chiefs, sure.
And they took that away from, they broke up that government.
Yep.
So it's about the clans coming back together again. Just like you found out that you were a Benjamite,
mm-hmm.
you find out that I was a Levite.
Well,
the
interesting thing about Benjamites is their symbol is the wolf.
And yeah,
They were the most militarily, naturally skilled tribe of Israel. And I believe that, and of course, the in the old Cherokee Nation, they were the majority, and they always did everything first. So did the tribe of Benjamin. They actually jumped into the Reed Sea before Moses used his staff to part it. So I there's just too many coincidences there. There's a lot of strange coincidences, too, between, for instance, I wasn't breastfed, neither was Benjamin. There's 12 years difference between me and my sibling, so was Benjamin. It goes on and on. It's spooky.
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean.
And my Torah portion covers the birth of Benjamin, so it's like, you know, oh, well. But there's a lot of people that are waking up to it, and they're, well, Rabbi Mikhail told me there's four levels of spirituality in Yeretz Israel, and he said, you know, in Israelites, the bottom level, he says, rabbis are the second level, he says, the entire tribe of Benjamin are called minor Zadiks, and then you've got, you know, the Zadiks and the, you know, the people that, you know, transcend time and space, and so that kind of accounts for some of the stuff that's happened to me, but your Torah portion, you know, God spoke, and God has spoken to you.
Yes. Did you say it's God spoken to me?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. You can't deny it. And
oh, yes, he has. Absolutely, yeah.
Volunteer that information, and which qualifies you for, well, you know, before 1998 when they rewrote the DSM Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Up until that time, it was written by one man, and anybody that heard voices was considered to be schizophrenic. But after that, they compiled it by committee, and they allowed for cultural differences. So if you hear voices, you know, they don't automatically think you're crazy.
Well, they would have put Moses away.
That's right.
He was here this time, right? But, yeah, I have heard the voice. It's mostly... in the spirit, you know, I mean, in your spirit, you see what I mean? But I have heard your voice, too.
In the sleep, mostly, that's when I get it.
Dreams and visions, and that's what I have. I have dreams and visions. And I really believe that, you know, there is a pastor friend of mine, he's Cherokee, okay? And he wants me to start a congregation. I want to start of Torah followers. It's got to be of Torah.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so he's going to allow the door to open to do that. And really what I want to do is that, and also, do you know there's a prophecy, I think it's in Isaiah, about there's an ensign, a flag,
mm-hmm.
that is a sign for the people. And it's so, you know, because the people are supposed to return to their tribes, clans, and families.
Uh-huh.
And I truly believe that's going to happen before, you know, like the second Exodus.
Uh-huh.
So they have to get organized just like they were organized in Egypt. And one thing that years ago that God had showed me was that we were living in Egypt. And, you know, I was born in Bethesda. Now, I say Kevin John, but it's part of Bethesda, so
uh-huh.
Bethsaida, which is House of Kindness. And that is Upper Egypt. That's where you have... I worked in Alexandria when I was in the military,
uh-huh.
the Pentagon. That's and Washington, D.C., the Potomac River is like the Nile.
Uh-huh.
The White House is like the House
uh-huh.
of the Pharaoh.
Well, Bethesda means the house of how it's. It means house of Esda. Beth's house.
What is that? House of Esda.
Beth means house. Beth. Yeah.
Yeah. The house of Esda.
Uh huh.
And so you have the White House, which is the house of the Pharaoh, and then
uh-huh.
you have the obelisk in front.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay, so that's Upper Egypt. And then Lower Egypt, you have Memphis, Tennessee.
That's right.
As you go into Memphis, you cross the river. It's there's a pyramid. and the king lives there. That's Elvis. That's just for a funny.
Yeah. Well, he was Cherokee too, you know, what the heck.
That's right.
Yeah, there's they purposely designed the capital to awe people but they use the obelisks or raised pyramids and basically, well, I knew a man in Utah by the name of Avram Gileadi. He went to the same yeshiva in Jerusalem, where if you drive through the neighborhood and you're not dressed right, the kids will throw rocks at you.
Yeah.
But he was a very interesting guy and a Jew. And he shared some things with me, and I'll be darned if I can remember what the heck they were. But I know what you mean about getting old. but he became a Mormon and BYU professor and did a new translation of Isaiah. But he had some really fascinating insights. And I met him at my friend White Eagle's house, and he was going through a sweat lodge ceremony back in 93 or so, and we got to be pretty good friends. And it's amazing where you run across information, and I'll get back to the – I'm getting to be like Rolling Thunder. He told me – he says, I love children, and he says, I love people, but don't interrupt me. He says, sometimes I interrupt myself, and it would take a year before I get back to what I was.
I know exactly what he was talking about.
Yeah, you know, senior moment, brain fart, whatever you want to talk about. I'll remember what it is in a minute, but let's get back to what you were talking about, and then I'll probably remember.
Oh, boy, now you're bringing me back to what I was talking about.
Yeah,
okay.
If you can remember. I have a talent for getting people off on tangents, and it's just... It gets crazy. You should have seen it when Chief Joe and I spent three days together last June, and it was like this.
So what did I say again?
But go ahead.
Well,
go ahead.
I was invited. I was on this other show, Red Town Radio. It's through Block Talk Radio, and I was invited on the show. I had to talk about my book, and there was the former chief of the Navajo in Yellowknife.
Uh-huh.
They called in Nolan Villebrun.
Uh-huh.
And she called in, very very nice lady, and we're just on the same page, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so then we talked privately, you know. And she invited me for a women's conference, the Native Women's Conference in Yellowknife, this summer.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, very nice. And then I was invited by he's also Dine, or I mean, he's also, see, there I go again.
Navajo, yeah.
And,
Dene is Navajo. Dene is they're the same people. They, the Dene and the Dene, they share a bear clan. We did a show last Friday night on this subject, and we had Brian Wilkes and Forrest Liggett on. If you get a chance to listen to him, because we were talking about.
I heard that show.
Yeah, and they were saying that old Navajo has some of the sounds that old Cherokee has in it. So linguistically, you know, things change. I mean, Cherokees aren't even speaking their own language anymore. We stopped speaking our language to stop the war between us and the Iroquois. And there are fragments of our old language, and a few of the Ottawahees have them and keep them pretty secret. But I suspect that it would prove even closer ties. You know, it's like the Bat Creek Stone. And
yeah.
other finds that have indicated that. Although the way Rolling Thunder explained to me, he said we had a lot of different people that came from different places at different times, and I think that blood arrived because it was Creator's plan But the Kitu'a do openly say that they are the chief of all tribes in North America, and if the Creator is to deliver a message to the Indians of North America, it will come through them, which kind of makes them the equivalent of the chosen people.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It's the little yellow pill that scientists say could eliminate chronic diseases and help you live well into your hundreds.
You might be able to increase the lifespan of a mammal by 50%. And, of course, if that was a human being, then that might be in the order of 130 to 150 years.
That claim might be hard to swallow, but tonight on ABC's Primetime Live, co-anchor John Quiñones takes the promising antioxidant therapy called Protandim.
I have become a guinea pig for ABC News and Primetime. It's not a drug. It's a supplement. It's called Protandim, and it's a combination of five exotic plants that have been around for centuries.
Have you discovered the fountain of youth?
I wouldn't put it that way, but we may have discovered something that will tell us a lot more about how we age, what happens biochemically, and maybe how we can slow it down.
Quiñones has been taking Protandim for 2 weeks now and tells Extra,
I am sleeping better. I feel a lot better and also energized when I do wake up.
Primetime puts Protandim to the test tonight.
It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now.
Right. It would make them the equivalent of the Orthodox
almost. And they have publicly announced in 1984, between 82 and 84, they did a, if you go to Kitu'aSociety.org, you can watch the video. They publicly announced and showed the wampum belts and announced that they were Israel.
Well, did they?
Yeah. And you can go to AmericanCherokeeAssociation.com and got all those videos and all kinds of evidence that we're connected with the Hebrews.
Well, so I was going to say about the, like the Kitu'as, see, the only problem here, the only problem that I see is the, you know, when the Cherokee, is for the, with the women, okay, because when the, before, like we were saying, there's a balance there, there was a balance. And there's really an imbalance now. This is the reason why you have, as far as I'm concerned, this is the reason why you have all of this nonsense going on about who can be in the tribe, or, you know.
Yeah.
Because I know people that are of other tribes. One is in the Cheyenne. She's actually... she's actually Crow, and she was telling me that her sister was born a couple years after her, but is unable to become a member of the tribe.
Because they changed the rules, yeah.
They changed the rules, and I'm saying, you know what? If if women were able to do the job that they're supposed to, that would not happen.
Well, I'll tell you, all you have to do is go to the library and find any book. Like, for instance, when I was in Chicago a couple of years ago, I got a book called Jewish Literacy, another book called Essential Judaism, Complete Guide to Beliefs, Customs, and Rituals. And I also read other books that are given to people that are thinking about converting. And it's absolutely astounding. Suddenly you come to the realization that these people are just as tribal as Indians. They think that way. A lot of people don't realize this. And, you know, in the Hebrew way, you know, you're not under covenant unless your mother was under covenant, but, you know, you inherit the tribe through your father. And the way God manifests himself to Israel was at night. It was the Shekinah, which was a feminine aspect of God. And during the day, it was the a pillar of smoke which is the male aspect. And there's probably, oh, I don't know, I was reading something that Philippe Savage, who's the last in the line of the Druidic Celtic tradition, and he was saying there's been changes in the way traditions have been transmitted down through the ages. He says, but basically, his people, the people, the Boreans, the people that originated in the North Country, they dispersed all over the planet, and everybody's related that way because you know, God arranged for there to be a disaster, and the people moved. And when you take a look at the prophecies, the things that God promised, like He promised that the eagles of Ephraim would be the protectors and would stretch its wings and protect Israel, that wouldn't have happened unless Ephraim and its nine other allied tribes had not gone into and not left the land and gone into exile, and their descendants became people in Northern Europe and the United States and fulfilled that prophecy. And the Bible says that the scepter will remain with Judah until Shiloh comes.
Right.
And a lot of people think Shiloh equals, they're actually taught that Shiloh is the Messiah, but actually Shiloh was the place where the it's in the territory. It means city of Ephraim, and it's the place where the tabernacle resided for some, I think, 160 years during the time.
Before it went to Jerusalem.
Yeah, before the temple was finished.
Mm-hmm.
So Joseph's descendants.
Right. So it was with them until that time.
Right. They've got a major promise, and the 2,730 year exile was over with the very same week of the major collapse in October 2008, which changes everything. Things like this happen, and you know, who knows what's going to happen now as far as disasters and everything, but you can be sure that people get comfortable where they're at, and you know, people also blame, and then when bad things happen, they move. And people blame the Jews for all kinds of calamities and economic problems, but had they not been turned out of their houses in the middle of the night, they all the time, they would not have adopted professions, portable professions like doctor, lawyer, shoemaker, a jeweler, and you know, eventually they accumulated wealth. And they knew the secret was to live on half your income just in case. And but I think Torah observance is very important for Jews because they're extremely intelligent people. And if they don't study Torah and put all their mental energy toward making money, then they there can be an imbalance there. And you know, anybody can get greedy, but they're great people, and they're brave people, and their people and American Indians, they're really the only people that are resisting the tyranny of the world anymore.
Right.
So I've had my soliloquy.
Well, you know, here's something that I look at, because you were talking about like conversion to Judaism and stuff
uh-huh.
like that. As far as Israel is concerned, I'm talking about as far as joining the House of Israel, all you had to do was just follow the rules. That's it. I mean, that's
yeah.
the whole Megillah, so to speak, you know.
And Megillah is the Hebrew word, yeah.
Right, the whole Megillah, right? Now, the thing is that in Judaism, because they are a tribe, okay, that is, in other words, to become a part of the Cherokee, well, that's another issue. Let's pick a different tribe. to become a part of one of the tribes, let's say the Cheyenne, Northern Cheyenne, you have to do certain things. or to become a part of one of the three federally recognized tribes of the Cherokee. You know what I mean? You have to go by certain rules. Rules. It's like a citizenship thing. Okay? So to become a part of the citizenship of Israel, I'm talking about the House of Israel now, not the country, you have to follow the Torah. That's what God gave through Moses to give to the people. That's it. Now, what Judaism does is they bring their own perceptions in here. And they, you know, that's when they came back from Babylon. And a lot of things changed there, okay? And so, I mean, there it's the rules to become a Jew. Well, that's Yehuda. But if you happen to be part of the other tribes, then that doesn't apply to you. You see what I mean? So if you're a Benjamite, you're a Benjamite. I'm a Levite, I'm a Levite. You know, I'm not from Yehuda. So they all have their different rules and stuff. And but the nation has to have one constitution, and that constitution is the Torah. So they're basically saying that you can't become. Well, there people don't understand that Judaism is not representative of the House of Israel. That's what they don't understand.
Well, there are two separate kingdoms. The House of Israel is a northern kingdom. The House of Judah is a southern. And there was that split because Solomon's son decided he was going to tax the people led by Ephraim. And there are 10 tribes up there, and Simeon and Judah in the south with a little bit of Benjamin. A lot of people don't know that Benjamin was a northern tribe, too, and they were forever assigned to the House of Joseph because of the arrangement of the stealing of the cup.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. And the tribe of Benjamin marched out, you know, with the sons of Joseph. And Benjamin became Joseph's administrator. And Benjamin was the only son born in the land. So they have a pivotal role. And their when you read their blessing that they were given by Jacob, they were to divide the spoil.
Right.
Right. And so I think they're going to have a pivotal role in determining, you know, who's going to go where and what inheritance they're going to get when Israel does finally become the last world superpower after all the other governments come to a full end.
Yes. Well, the inheritance of course, it's not like it is right now, but, you know, it was mapped out who was going to get what.
Right.
And so that's what you're saying, that Benjamin is the administrator?
Well, when I was in one of these books, I was reading that the founders of the state of Israel back in the 40s, they knew they had no right to name their country Israel.
Yes.
Because they were not Israel. And this is a very little known fact, but it's easily verifiable. They the Jews had been waiting forever for Israel to return. And you know, finally, it just kind of got dropped from memory and dropped from lexicon. But I guarantee you the Orthodox rabbis know what I'm talking about. And a lot of Jews know what I'm talking about. I can't remember the name of the archaeologist. Maybe I'll remember in a minute. But there was a satellite picture taken of Israel. And in the mountains east of Israel, written in the rocks, by the way the water courses ran, you can read the word Ephraim just as if it was the title holder to the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And the West Bank, the Shomron, that is our inheritance. And
yes.
It's the highlands. It's where the water is. It's where the oil is, which is they're looking for now. They have discovered it. They just It's not in commercial quantities yet. The natural gas has been discovered, but Obadiah, who was a non-Hebrew but a prophet nevertheless, warned that if his cousins, you know, were on that piece of real estate when Joseph's descendants came back to inherit it, that they'd be burned to stubble. So, you know, it's a fringe lunatic thing, but you know, there are some people that are aware that that those people need to be moved over to Gaza, and that Gaza needs to be extended further north. They need to do, you know, what they basically did in India, which was move populations. And but it's really going to be interesting to see what's going to happen. And
well, I, you know, when I was telling you about that prophecy, it's in Isaiah. It's Isaiah 11:11.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, Isaiah 11:12 actually says, "He shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." And I, you know, that's what I believe that is taking place now. That's what
exactly.
I believe. You know, that the tribes have to get together, and then they will, because he says, "I'm going to cause you to leave." Well, what has he caused? It's either an economic situation, or it's just like in Mexico where they're having all these rumblings now, all of these earthquakes and stuff.
Famine, drought, war, pestilence.
And they say, "Hey, we're getting out of here." You know, so, but they, before moving out, they have to be in their tribes, because once they get there, then they're going to have to go to their inheritances, the land. So is that like the 10 tribes you're talking about that in the Shomron?
That's our inheritance. Benjamin is the extreme southern one, and actually the Temple Mount itself is in Benjamin's inheritance, and that's the reason why Benjamites guarded the temple.
Oh, okay.
But they're a northern tribe.
Uh-huh.
But they became, Simeon and Judah basically became the house of Judah. But there's also, you know, the people of all the tribes really that didn't want to get involved with the idolatry that was going on in the northern kingdom, they also moved down around Jerusalem too. So, you know, they're, you know, what are called Jews today, you know, they've got Judah, they've got Levites, Benjamin, and who knows what all.
Right. Everybody is kind of mixed in there. It's but when the other tribes come, I mean, there's just a lot of people.
Exactly.
And I think mostly they came over here to the States, you know, because this is where, well, I mean, a lot of them have stayed, just like when they stayed in Egypt. You know, you have people that stay in Germany or stay in these countries. I don't know why they're staying there. I couldn't figure out why they want to go back to a country that,
right,
you know.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated.
Good.
and freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Osmond.
Put
it under your bed. Put it in your closet. Give it for Christmas to people and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
Well, there's also a prophecy in Isaiah that says that, maybe I'll have to look it up, but there is someday to be a man like unto Moses.
Right.
And of course, God made it clear that there would never be a prophet like Moses again, but there's supposed to be a one like unto Moses that will gather, the prophecies that have to do with the Messiah haven't been fully fulfilled yet, particularly with the gathering of the people, establishing peace, the rabbis argue about this a little bit, but basically this is, you know, not the Messiah, but a branch, but there is to be this figure that is supposed to come at some point. And it's kind of interesting, what the Jews are thinking about Messiah right now kind of mirror what the Hopis say about the true white brother. Some people believe that Pahana, a true white brother, is one person, but many believe that it's a nation of people. And the Hopi expected different waves of white people that were coming. They knew the Spanish were coming. They recognized the turtle-shaped hats that they were wearing, the helmets. But they knew that there would be people that would come with a flat-brimmed hat. They would be carrying a cross. But if the cross had one leg longer than the other, they would be unbalanced, and they wouldn't be as helpful to the people as, say, the Celtic people. And when you look at the flag of Switzerland, and Switzerland is traditionally, the white people are supposed to be keepers of the fire, black people keepers of the water, yellow people keepers of the air, and the red people keepers of the earth. And all of these people have really fallen short of, particularly the pollution that's going on in Asia is awful that the Chinese are doing, and the situation of water in Africa is dismal. And white people were the first to really pervert fire, radiation. Exactly. But, you know, a man has come forward the last few years by the name of Philip Savage, and he's got some really interesting things to say. He healed about 50,000 people on TV. And then when the communist government came into France, he was hounded, and for a while he was the most wanted person in Interpol, and they were chasing him because he's supposedly practicing medicine without a license. But that's just his way of proving who we are, and he has the same kind of gifts. He's a Celt. He's a Druid. And Ed McGough thoroughly believes that Native American religions, as they are today, were seeded by Druids and Celtic people, because they're basically the same religion. But Philip Savage admires two groups of people, Native Americans and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And because he resonates with them, and they're brave people, and I don't want to get off on Philip. I can talk for hours about that, but I wanted you to know about this man.
Oh yeah, that's good. Well, I mean, if you take away the money from the medical community, which fondly called the legal drug cartel,
mm-hmm.
take away their money. I mean, it would be so great, you know, to have people healed and all this kind of stuff without shelling out the the money. But I don't see that's going to happen right here. Not without a big fight, you know.
Exactly.
But,
exactly. But I was looking at this prophecy of the prophet like unto Moses. The Christians claim it was Jesus. The Muslims claim it was Muhammad. But interesting, they both fulfilled parts of it, but no one has yet really gathered the tribes and brought
them. Yeah, that's
them
what I mean. Jesus was more to the, as far as Joseph, you know, like the brothers not recognizing him and, you know, different things.
He said he came only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, which
right.
is the northern kingdom. And his followers, basically, that's who they are, because the northern kingdom that moved up into Asia Minor and other places, they were the first to be converted to Christianity, and they'd forgotten who they were in a lot of ways. But, yeah, somehow it's all going to come together, and soon.
And I think there's going to be several or, you know, different people who are a part of this trying to get the tribes together.
Well, that's happening.
You know, I mean, I don't know why, but I'm involved. I am thinking about the clans because I know they have to return to their clans, tribes, and families. So what you were talking about, the Torah portion,
mm-hmm.
that's a great way of identifying the people.
I'll tell you what, it's stunning. The when Magid Ben Yosef told me mine, it was like I was hit by a thunderbolt. It hasn't, because the rabbis say that everyone's name is somehow encoded in the Torah, and this is how. This is a personal prophecy, and you know, if you're halfway in tune, it really has an effect on you, because like you, I mean, you had inklings that you were a Levite.
Yeah.
And my wife is a Levite also. She has a slightly different Torah portion. But, yeah, it's...
Well, here's another thing, Blue Otter. Here's something else, too. You see, I was adopted. Okay. And like Moses, like I say, if God did not want Moses to find out who he was, he wouldn't have told him.
Right.
It just wouldn't have been an issue, you know. He would just let the people out and this and that, and, you know, he didn't need to know any more than that. But, you know, I believe that the Creator knew how important it was to know who you are and where you belong and what your purpose is, how it all comes together. So I look at Moses as the great adoptee, okay? He was adopted by an Egyptian, and for all practical purposes, he was an Egyptian.
Uh-huh.
You know, when he goes back to Israel, or, well, I'm sorry, when he goes back to Egypt and to the Hebrews, they really don't even know who he is. He is not one of them. No. That's why I resonate with Moses, and of course Moses is a Levite. Although he didn't have any kind of, you know, he didn't have any, like Aaron, he wasn't in charge
uh-huh.
of religious services or anything. You know,
he was in charge of all.
Yeah, and so he was, all he did was really to get the people together and to lead them. he wasn't involved in the day-to-day services at the tabernacle or anything. So...
Well, Moses, there is also a prophecy that talks about the poor brothers of the Hebrews will have some kind of a pivotal point or a pivotal role in all this. But basically what the Bible said is he would, and this is in Moses' time, in Deuteronomy 18:18, he was told that I'll raise up a prophet. He's talking to Moses. He says, I'll raise up a prophet like you from among their brothers, and I'll put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him. And anyone that doesn't listen to that prophet speaks in my name, I'll call him to account. And he says, and a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I haven't told him to say or speaks in the name of other gods, you must put him to death. But you may say to yourselves, you know, how can we know when a message has not been spoken by the Lord? He says, and if a prophet proclaims the name of the Lord doesn't come, take place or come true, then that the message that message the Lord hadn't spoken, and the prophet has spoken presumptuously, don't be afraid of him. He says, and when the Lord your God destroyed the nations whose land he is giving you, and when you have driven them out and settled in their towns and houses, then set aside for yourselves three cities centrally located in the land the Lord has given you to possess. Build roads. And basically he was telling them what to do and establish cities of refuge like the Cherokee.
That's what they did in North Carolina.
Right. And but there's this prophecy that somewhere down the road there'll be a man like Moses that will come and gather the people together. The Jews are expecting him. We're expecting him. The Christians, think it was Jesus and he will return. But the Jews made a delineation, and they were talking about this a couple thousand years ago. And if anybody really wants to get to the bottom of this, get a book called The Messiah. I'll remember it in a minute. I remember the name of the book in a minute. But, everybody's waiting with bated breath for things to happen. And the Messiah Papers.
Messiah Papers.
Yeah, the Messiah Papers, I'm pretty sure. And but there is this prophecy hanging out there that there would be someone that would come. And Jesus, and Pope John Paul II, who, by the way, his mother was a Jew, and the Orthodox rabbis accepted as a Jew, he figured out that Christians should not be missionizing Jews because they're under their own covenant. They don't need to be missionized. They don't need they have a completely separate arrangement. And the Catholics stopped missionizing them and actually started bringing rabbis into Catholic schools. So things are changing.
They brought rabbis in a Catholic school.
Yep. Yep. To to talk about, there's still that low wall, between the two faiths, but the ice is breaking.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I don't believe that Christianity as we know it today should be missionized in any way.
Yeah.
Now the first century is a different horse of a different color,
Right.
Now, the only difference between them, because they studied Torah with them, and everything, the first century believers, the only difference was they happened to believe that Jesus or Yeshua was the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after all, the people believed that, at one time believed that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. And they were wrong.
And Rabbi Schneerson? It's, what it is, it's...
Rabbi Schneerson, yes.
It's considered to be, as long as you don't believe a person is a deity, it's considered not to be proper, but it's tolerated in Judaism. There's a group in Ra'ana near Haifa, near Tel Aviv, that they're known as the Netzarim, and they're under the protection of... a synagogue there, and they believe Jesus is Moshiach, but they don't believe he was Shtuf or deity. And of course you had Tzvi, other group of people. I'm a little tired, so I can't remember. But about 1,000 years ago, there was a man that... a lot of people believe. I guess it was 1666. The Sabbateans.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of groups and Bar Kokhba and others that they've. And there was 80 people running around the Holy Land when Jesus was alive, and proclaiming themselves as the Messiah. And but basically, Christians, what they believe a Messiah is. is more closely akin to the idea of savior, which came down from the Roman and Greek pagan cults.
Oh, exactly. That's true. And that's why I'm saying that the Christianity, as people know it today, is not what the believers, first century believers, were a part of. So that's a whole another ball of wax there. But I happen to believe, as far as Yeshua is concerned, and that he is, the suffering servant. And I know that, in Judaism they like to say that, it's Israel, believe what you want to believe. I happen to believe it's Yeshua. And that goes along with the typhus, and why he tore his, why he ripped his clothes and all kinds of things.
Right.
All
anybody has to do is just go to a Passover service at a Messianic congregation, you'll get the picture.
Yeah. And so the Messianics are kind of like the filtering system, you know what I mean? And as long as they don't go off on a tangent and bring in certain Christian doctrine or certain doctrines.
Right.
Even with through Judaism. I mean, Judaism has their own things that they brought back from Babylon.
Well, Halakha. The way Rabbi Michiel explained Halakha to me, he said, the Northern Kingdom, he says, we didn't quite go as far as the Northern Kingdom did. We didn't take the Ark out and replace it with Baal. But he says, we have a little bit different deal with the Lord. But he says, we know that if we don't adhere to a certain set of principles, we're just that close to losing the status also. He says, but basically, they're a boat in the middle of the ocean without a rudder, and they're hanging on by their teeth to, what they've been given. But I kind of look at Halakha, it's like I wrote a letter to Rabbi Michiel, and I told him, I said, I've seen this phenomena in the Christian church and the Mormon church where you're given an original set of instructions, and then drift happens, and, 40, 50, 100 years later, the leaders start writing things and commentaries on things, and they're well-meaning, but the original leaders die off, and then dogma happens, and before you know it, you've got you're just completely, it's like the Mormon church, there's not a thing in the Book of Mormon that the Mormon church is still practicing. And I kind of looked at, when I originally started looking at looking into the Talmud, there wasn't any, people talking really nasty about Jesus until after the persecution started up. And you kind of look at the timeline I can understand, why, some of them would just want to spit on you, and I've opened a briefcase in front of a Hopi man and about got the same reaction, and it's just like my 11th great granduncle. He said, many proposals have been made, for the Cherokee to adopt, white religion and manner of dress and customs. He says we would be much better pleased if we could see you do these things and to hear you talk about them.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Hi, friends. This is Will Blue Otter. I have a message here from 1975 from John Wayne. It comes right out of today's headlines. So you Indian folks who are following the progressive trend in politics, you're following the people that supported slavery. You're following the people that have enslaved you ever since the Civil War. Listen to John Wayne.
You know, it's a funny thing, the Indians now. this AIM group have started something that now they're against me for some reason. But I am the only man in pictures that always gave them their human dignity. I never was in a picture. I never allowed myself at any time to do anything that would take their human dignity away from them. And that, to me, is the most important thing in a man. I have found that a certain type that calls himself a liberal, I always thought I was a liberal. I came up terribly surprised one time when I found that I was a right-wing conservative extremist. When I have listened to everybody's point of view that I ever met and then decide how I should feel. I mean, but this so-called new liberal group, Jesus, they never listen to your point of view, and they make a decision as to what you think, and they're articulate enough and in control of enough of the press to force that image out for the average person. For some reason, maybe it's these pictures, they have not been able to do that with me. In spite of what they say, people have not taken sides that I'm it hasn't affected my career in popularity, let's say. In spite of the fact that they've tried to make it do it. There isn't a hell of a lot that we can do to change human behavior. We keep making laws to try and change human behavior. You can't do it. I think you can accept it and feel how you would feel in that position. You're being conned into Keynesianism and socialism now. But it isn't going to stop the selfishness of human behavior. It isn't going to stop the greed. If you take $20 and give a dollar to every son of a bitch in a room and come back a year later, one of the bastards will have most of the money. I mean, it's just human nature, and you're not going to whip it with a lot of laws. I think when you make people conscious, as communication gets better, and you make people conscious of somebody in trouble, starving or something like that, the average person will help. But of course, now they've got so damn many charities, and there's so much professionalism. You know, if you have a charity, you hire some professionals to work up the charity. By the time you get the money, you get $4 for the recipient and $400 for the administrators. So, I mean, Christ, I think there are people who try to affect a thinking where they know more than some other son of a bitch and try to put a false impression on what human nature is. Christ's sakes, we have proven that we go back to hope at the first opportunity. Just throw out a little fish and bam, they're out there ready to grab it. So we are optimistic. We have to be optimistic. Christ, what else would there be in life if you lose optimism?
You're right.
And Christians, in a lot of ways, they're a huge death cult. They've murdered hundreds of millions of people in the name of Jesus, and then they expect us not to resist.
Right, and the bad thing about it has nothing to do with Jesus. You know,
that's right.
All of this has to do with men that wanted control.
That's right.
And, you know, that's it. They want control. That's the whole thing about secession
and, you know, the knife and council and all this kind of stuff. It's about control.
Oh, my gosh. You know, there was a riot that broke out during the Nicene Council. I think it was 800 men there, and they had to call like 3,000 troops to break the riot up. Get a book called The Bible Fraud by Tony Bushby and read it, and you'll find out. You know, the early Catholic Church was just full of frauds and charlatans, and it was a.